Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, and it's an honor and a privilege for me to have my next guest on today, Ian Thornley. I was telling Ian he was one of the guys before I started this show. You know, I had like a list of 10 or 15 or 20 maybe guitar players, and he was one of the guys on it, so I'm really happy that we finally got to connect. If you're not familiar with Ian, man, you're in for a treat. He's just a great spirit, and musically, this guy is... Man, one of the most talented people I've ever had the fortune of listening to. A couple of quick announcements. I want to thank Andy Curran for making this happen, and I want to thank Darren Gilmore and Ben Button for putting this together and organizing it. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the audio, and if you're watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and the bell. All right, a little bit about Ian, and then we'll get into this. Originally from Toronto, Canada, which is where he is now, he's best known for being the lead guitarist, singer, and songwriter of Big Wrecked. The band was formed by Ian and some of his friends when they were at Berkeley. And I'm going to spare Ian from having to deal with three or four questions he's probably been asked a million times. So I'm going to just summarize some of the things that he went through with the band early on. Okay, 1997, the first album comes out. It's called In Loving Memory. If you do nothing else, if you get nothing else out of this interview, go listen to In Loving Memory and then thank me later. Every song on that record it's phenomenal, off the charts, and the album went double platinum. So what happened was Atlantic Records let the band make the record they wanted to make. For the second record, though, which was called The Pleasure and the Greed, and that came out in 2001, as is very common, as we've talked to loads of people who've been on the show, Atlantic had massive expectations. They got way too involved in the productions. They were really preoccupied with making hit singles. And as we've heard time and again, things did not work out, caused stress for everyone, and led to internal conflicts. And all those things combined and caused the band to break up at that time. Ian went out and formed Thornley. He released two albums, one in 2004 and one in 2009. In 2010, though, Big Wreck reunited, and since then, they've released four more records, including last year's But for the Sun, which is fucking great. Of those four records, three of them charted top five in Canada, and three of them, not the same three, charted top 10 here in the States. So he's making music just as good today as he's ever been. And before COVID-19 came, Ian and Big Wreck was actively touring, and they had a nice tour planned for Canada as well this summer that got canceled, but stay tuned. Also, in 2015, Ian released a solo record. I would really encourage you to check this out. It's called Secrets, and he released that under Ian Fletcher Thornley, which I think you played all the instruments on there, didn't you?
No. I just did my usual plunking around on guitars and mandolins and ukuleles. Dave McMillan played bass, and Glenn Milcham, actually, the drummer from Blue Rodeo, joined on drums and percussion. And,
oh, very cool. Because I looked up the credits.
You played a fishbowl on that record.
That's a great record.
Filled it with water and sort of hitting it with a mallet until it, I think it would, tried to get it to be a C natural, and then
whatever you did at work, it's a great record, man.
Yeah, no, it's just live. It's, we just went up to a cottage, maybe 2 hours north of here, with Mark Howard. And, you know, if you're familiar with his work, it's just, he's the a lot of the Daniel Lanois records are Mark steering the ship, as well as Danny, obviously. But we just went up with Mark, and then I think we spent 2 weeks there and essentially just cut a record. He just sort of made a studio out of this little A-frame cottage, and that was it.
Beautiful record, man.
Thanks.
Amazing record. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
No, man,
it's my pleasure. And thank you for, before I start, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything you've done musically, because I've spent a lot of time listening to you. And man, you have put out so many good vibes for me, and I know for so many others out there. So I really appreciate what you've done.
Thanks.
All righty. What prompted you to go to Berkeley to study jazz?
It gets a bit of a rap, but not really a rap. It gets there's a stigma attached with that, which I never really thought of us as a Berkeley band. I never thought of myself as a Berkeley guy, but essentially because I wasn't going to do anything else. I knew I was, by the time it was, time for post-secondary, it was like either, go to college or get a manual labor job. So I had to sort of charm my way out of high school. Cause I was just by the last year of high school, I was just a terrible student. I wasn't going to do anything else. I was going to do music. And by the time I got to Berkeley, I think I stuck to the curriculum, which is like you said, it's a jazz thing, which isn't my bag. But they use it as a sort of as the tool. That's the language they use to teach the curriculum. By the time I stayed there for 3 years, I did not get a piece of paper. By the time I hit my last year there, I was just taking courses with teachers that I liked, and just trying to pick their brains about, because I knew when I left, I wasn't gonna do fusion or jazz or straight ahead or anything. I don't have nothing against any of that. It's never really tugged at me the way some other stuff has. And it was a great experience in a lot of ways, but there is a stigma attached, and a lot of people, I was at a dinner with Andy Curran.
That's funny.
And Big Al was there. Andy Curran, Alex Lifeson, and the guy from Porcupine Tree.
Oh, Stephen Wilson.
Stephen Wilson.
Yeah.
And I've known Al for a number of years, and he's great, and he's always a great hang, and he's hilarious, and that. And who were we talking about? People talk about other bands that are not in the room kind of thing. and here's why I went to dinner was because I was going to go down and see King's X was opening the show for Porcupine Tree.
All right.
And I met Doug a number of years before that. And I'm a huge King's X freak.
I just had Ty on here last week.
With Porcupine Tree. I didn't really know. And he was an interesting guy. I since have become a fan. But during that dinner, we were just sort of shooting the shit, and they started talking about Dream Theater, because Al was saying, "Yeah, that drummer from Dream Theater was Mike Portnoy."
Mike Portnoy, yeah.
It's like, man, he does everything just like Neil does. Like, he would set up his drums just like Neil, which is great. And then Stephen Wilson just started. I can't remember how it came up, and he was talking about Petrucci, and he was like, "Well, what do you want if the guy went to Berkeley?" And I was like, "I went to Berkeley," and that sort of speaks to what I'm, And if you listen to Stephen Wilson's music, it's not, three chords and the truth.
No, man.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
Very much.
We have a penchant for getting a little mathy ourselves, and I love all that. There's nothing. There's room for everybody.
Yeah.
But I really. It resonated with me that it is like, oh yeah, shit, there's a stigma attached to being a Berkeley nerd. And, John Mayer went to Berkeley. It's like, St. Vincent went to Berkeley. It's not, you don't always have to be Steve Vai or, you know.
No, totally.
Bruce Coburn went to Berkeley. I talked to him about that. I was never aware of that going up.
But I've had a ton of guys on the show like you that went there because it was like, well, I wanted to do music. I didn't know what else to do. And they weren't the same story. You know, they weren't into jazz at all. So
it's fine though. I mean, it was the first time in many years. And I started like getting really good marks, you know,
that's good, man. Very cool. When you guys first launched Big Wreck, what were some of the early challenges about getting the thing, you know, getting it momentum to get the airplane off the ground?
Getting gigs. Like when we, I had stayed in Boston after my third year of school, and my student visa was still valid. It was still, you know, so I just stayed down there. And Forrest, the drummer, he left after 1 year. I think it was 1 year or one semester. I think it was a year he left, but he'd gotten a little apartment in Natick. It's about a half an hour west of Boston. So I just kind of crashed on his floor. And then Brian finished after he had come up. Brian finished after 2 years. He got his degree or diploma, whichever one it is, the 2 year. And Brian had gone back down to New York. And then I was like, okay, well, let's give this a whirl after my third year. And then Brian moved up. And we all just kind of crashed in this place in Natick. It was basically a converted garage. it was brutal, but it was great for us because we could play all night and all day. And we started to put things together and get a sound together. But the hardest thing for us was getting gigs. It was just really, really hard to, you know, it was like TT the Bears in the Middle East and, Bills, and there was a few places in Boston where you could play, and it was really hard, you know. We did a few things here and there, but for the most part, it was like, well, if we're not going to get any gigs, we kept trying. Forrest was more that kind of guy.
Like right.
He sort of had the gift of gab a little more and would be able to try to line something up. But I mean, if we weren't going to be doing that, We just worked on our craft, you know, worked on trying to write songs and like I said, put our sound together and what is our thing and how do we sound as a unit. When I think back, we played a lot. We just jammed for hours and hours and hours, constantly looking for a singer. It was in those early days. It was hard to get a gig.
How did you get discovered by Atlantic, though? You must have been out playing somewhere.
Well, the timeline is a little foggy. We're talking, this is like 95, 96.
Sure.
But essentially, I got booted because my student visa had run out. Okay. And Forrest and I were coming back from Toronto. We had come here so I could grab some gear to go play some shows. And we were called Still Waters at the time. I had all the van full of guitar gear and a stack of posters with our picture on it, you know. And we're crossing the border and, you know, they immediately, I was in the passenger seat, Forrest is driving. And he's like, you guys look like musicians with one of those. And he looks in the back. He's like, what's all this? It's like, it's guitar gear. And he said, well, the Canadian guy, what do you play? And I said, I'm a drummer. I actually like did the, you know, dude. So they were like, yeah, why don't you just pull over here? We'll have a chat. And that was it. We got turned away. And then on the advice of my dad, he's like, well, just try it another spot. Just go to Montreal. So anyway, long story short, we tried that. We tried the midnight run, going over my girlfriend at the time who lived in Burlington, Vermont, had driven up. So we were going to go in one vehicle, Forrest would go in the other.
Okay.
But that didn't work. They were hip to it.
Holy shit.
Yeah, they took the van with all the gear in it and said, well, no, we're taking this. You're out of the country. And they were like, and we're going to take your car to my girlfriend. So she's losing it. I'm
oh my God.
It's two o'clock in the morning. Cause we figured when it was slow, it'd be easier. It was so scary, dude. It was so scary. Eventually, you know, they were actually pretty cool about it because it's like, you know, it's a federal offense. And I was like, I just want to go.
Like kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Music, it was 21. Yeah, I mean, a federal offense. You imagine.
So, yeah, long story short, they said, grab whatever you want out of the van. And you know, this is somewhere in South Quebec. So I grabbed it. Two guitars and two duffel bags, and then just started walking down the highway at 2 a.m.
Holy, brutal. With your girlfriend?
Anyway, they're like, yeah, you can't come into the U.S. for another 6 or 9 months or whatever it was. And they kept Forrest Van at the border for 6 months, I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then the irony of the whole thing is, it's not irony, but the funny part was after 6 months, Forrest went back up to that border to get his van, and then he looked in the, you know, the air conditioner vent things, and he had a one that would come out, and he took it out, and there was still a hash pipe, full hash pipe
that they missed.
They never found it. It was like 6 months, it's sitting right at the border.
It must have been great. 6 month old hash got.
Yeah, I don't know. I was never really a big fan, but Forrest, you know, he got away with it.
That's so funny.
So yeah, I was in Toronto at the time, and we had made all these. We made these little demos, and Forrest fancied himself a bit of an engineer at the time, and was just starting to put his sort of miking chops together. And we'd do our demos in that garage, and Forrest would acquire, like, bit by bit, getting more and more gear so that we could kind of make better demos. And he started to get pretty good at it, and we sent those demos around, and eventually they landed in Alan Gregg's lap, who is the manager of up here in Canada. Excuse me. And then Alan was like, "Well, I'd love to meet with Ian, because he knew that I was in Toronto now." So I met with him, and you know, we talked about music, we talked about this and that. And I said, but my band is in the States. Like, Brian had said, okay, I'm out. And he'd gone back to New York. And I think Henning was either, I think he was still in Boston, I think. Anyway, yeah. So he said, well, we can deal with the border stuff, because it's not like I got charged with anything. I wasn't really doing anything wrong. Although I did, you know, anyway. But so, yeah, he said, we can deal with that. We'll send you back down there. We can book your shows and blah, blah, blah. So I went down, and then I can't remember the whole timeline, but I went down. We started playing. They came up here, and then we started playing around Ontario, opening for different bands, you know, just to get some stage time. And yeah, we started doing demos at that time as well, at a place not far from where I live now called Presence, which is, I think it's gone, that studio. But a great old rickety studio that just had this sound, and that's the sound of the first record. But those are demos. The first record is demos.
That's amazing.
So we did two batches of these demos. We did an initial batch of maybe 6 or 9, or I can't remember. And then played around that summer, and then at the end of that summer, Brian was like, I'm out, I can't do this anymore. So he was like, we became a three piece essentially. And Brian was like, I mean, we were living above a fish market, and I was 2-3 days without food, and it was
oh, you my know, God,
they were grim times, and we weren't making any money. So yeah, Brian was like, I'm not going to live like this anymore because I don't have to. So he went back to New York, and then we tried to continue as a three piece. We did another batch of demos, which is the demos where the Oaf and that song and Blown Wide Open, all those tunes came from that. And we actually did a fair amount of touring in the Northeast of the U.S. As a three piece. And then, yeah, I think uh, and like I said, the timeline is kind of hazy. It was a long time ago.
Sure.
But we were doing showcases in New York at that time for all the majors. And as a three piece. And it was like, I was trying to run all this gear that I, you know, it was all Jimmy rigged together. Like none of it would work consistently. And I was just trying to get more sound. And it would shit the bed all the time. And sure enough, it shit the bed during one of our big showcases. And you know, Brian would come in when we were playing in New York and I'd hang with Bri. Like there was never any animosity there. It was,
sure.
He was still, you know. And then I was just like, dude, you got to come back. You know, you got to fill out the sound and help us out here. And then eventually I was able to talk him into it. Once Atlantic got a hold of those demos, we came down and did a proper showcase. Oh no, actually they came up. There was a few, we were, cause I distinctly remember Forrest and I being in LA during the mixing of the record with Jack Joseph and having to fly back to Toronto to play a gig. Like we took a red eye, played a showcase and then flew back. But see, it's all jumbled together. But
it's a long time ago, man.
Stage. We were in the Horseshoe and we came off stage and Craig Kalman was in our dressing room. He was like, you need to be on Atlantic Records. You have to be on Atlantic. There was a few different labels sort of scouting us at the time. And they flew us down to New York, gave us a tour of their facilities. And I got to meet Ahmet Erdogan, but he told me I was a great guitar player. And I was like, where's the dotted line? Pretty much like that. It's just an honor to be anywhere at that point. You know?
Yeah, of course, man.
So yeah, it was the record was already done. Cause it was demos.
That's amazing, man.
Oh yeah. It was a long fucking story.
Well, no, it's a long journey. It gotta be a long story.
You know what? Dave Henning would be able to, like, he had one of those memories, which I'm sure he still has, that he would probably have a better idea of the timeline and how things went. And I try to every once in a while I'll think about it and I'm just like, man, it is a foggy mess. Like it's just like, it was always like, I was never taking note of anything. I was always just like trying to get to the next, I still am. Like,
yeah.
Just trying to, you know, crawl forward.
But that's important, man. It's when that's what everybody's trying. I mean,
it's important to remember where you've been so you can.
No, but it's important to crawl forward, man. That's the way it works. You know, you got to, you know, every day, new thing.
Yeah, so.
Hey, so let me ask you, when In Loving Memory came out, you're in like probably your mid 20s. What I was curious about is the songs on there. They're incredibly emotional. I mean, like fucking like powerhouse, man, both lyrically and musically. It was almost like you're a guy who'd been in prison, like emotional prison, and then all of a sudden, like, I mean, you had a lot to say. I mean, very deep shit on there. And so what was the lead up? And then now you give me some of the backstory. A lot of them were demos. What was the lead up, though, to writing those songs, or what was going on in your life at the time? Because you had so much to say, and it was just so well emoted.
It's hard to say what affects what, you know. I just know what I like, and you try to write based on that. I don't want to write something that I don't like. And if I'm putting something together that doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel natural, doesn't feel authentic and true to me or to us, I'll bounce it. I'll say no. And back then there was a lot of trial and error. And we spent a lot of time, we logged a lot of miles before we ever even, you know, got into the studio. Because we were playing anywhere and everywhere that we could. And like I said earlier, I was trying to find a singer. We were trying to find a singer forever. And I don't know, there's like those first demos that most of which ended up being the first record. That's some of my first times really singing into a proper mic and hearing myself properly and like realizing that I could sort of fuck with it a bit, you know. Yeah. I can go up higher if I want, you know, things like that.
That must have been fun.
In a way, because I've always had, like, singers have a stigma. And I never wanted to be anywhere near that stigma, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be the sort of the David Lee Roth or the Robert Plant or the Mick, you know. I wanted to be the Keith and the Jimmy and
right,
the Eddie.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then I was like, well, wait a second, you know, and that's all bullshit anyway. It's just a stigma. None of it's real. But there is some truth to it. You know, the cliches are cliches for a reason.
You're talking about as far as being, you know, having to be the personality.
Things that are sort of image propelled.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or, you know, just all that stuff, which I think is, it's a way to date yourself.
Right.
And I never wanted to do that. I wanted to do things that had a little more depth to it. Not saying that Mick and
no,
and
no.
Rob, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no judgment. I understand.
Yeah. I didn't want to be like I don't want to use the term, but there's a term for it. And I'd met a few along the way and I was like, that guy's one of them. Like we were talking about, and we called him up. Blah, 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 you know, the front guy who needs an I'm a Singer ramp and the whole bit. And then,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, God. Because we were all musos, right? We were
right.
All trying to. So I, you know, it was, there was sort of a, eventually a, there was an acceptance of it. Like, well, fuck it. I'm going to be the guy. I'll be the singer guy. And I fight, to this day, I still fight with it on some level. But yeah. But anyway, as far as the songwriting and, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with luck, right time, right place, and you know, hopefully, just hoping that you're barking up the right tree or that you're shaking the right tree to have something fall in your lap that's like, okay, this is ripe, and I think you can sort of shape your own luck by, you know, right now. You just never know.
Yeah.
So the more you can put the work in. But yeah, you know, I think the things that I'll draw on for inspiration or sort of subject matter, it ranges and it varies, and it, you know, as long as, like I said earlier, as long as it feels not forced, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, man, that it's rare to get a any record, but let alone a first record where everything is so, like, has that depth.
Yeah, I hear some, I hear some juvenile moves. When we did that tour a couple of years ago, the 20-year anniversary tour.
Yeah.
And so I had to go back and sort of really revisit and listen to, and I'm just like, oh, I would never do that now.
Because you're a different, you know, your mind, you're older, man. You're not thinking the same way. The things that cause you pain.
Like really cheap rhyming schemes and things like that. And I'm just like, oh, God, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm like, hey, man, it was the 90s.
It was awesome, dude.
That's bullshit.
Just say, no, it was great. There's nothing.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
I love it. It sounds like a band that's been leathered up.
Fucking sounds great.
And is hungry and ready to, you know, and I like that.
Yeah.
That vibe.
So I have some questions about a couple. I just want to ask you about some of my favorite Big Wreck and Ian Thornley songs. And if you're uncomfortable sharing any of the stuff I asked, just that's totally cool. Just let me know. So Blown Wide Open. I mean, like, I have yet, it's impossible for me to hear, to just hear the beginning of that song and not just like, I don't, no matter how involved I am or deep in something else, everything stops and it's like a a sonic and emotional magnet. That is such a powerful song. I was curious just about the lyrics in particular. You know, you talk about all the stuff that you were putting away, and I was just curious, did you mean that, and this is a long time ago, you may never know that question, did you mean that you were putting it away because you had finished dealing with it, or putting it away so you didn't have to deal with it?
Yeah, more it would have been more the latter. Especially knowing myself in my early 20s.
I had a funny feeling. I'm thinking, this guy's in his early 20s. He wasn't who's dealing with shit?
Avoiding shit.
Yeah, who's... Sure.
At least that's probably what I was thinking at the time. I have a very distinct memory of when the line Blown Wide Open sort of fell in my lap. Like we were a three piece, and we took a summer where the three of us lived in a motel in Portland, Maine, a great town.
I've actually been there.
however many years ago it was. And there was a local bar venue, which we'd become friends with them, and they were great people, and they really took us in and let us play there sort of a couple nights a week or whatever. And we just sort of got into this group of friends, but we had a little rehearsal spot, which was a garage. There was mechanics coming in and grabbing things, and while we were jamming away. And we were just going back and forth with these two chords. And then I just remember singing that line, Blown Wide Open. I was like, I got to remember this one. Blown Wide Open, Blown Wide Open. And I just remember, you know, putting it together in my head after we did the jam. It's a very simple song, but usually the good ones, you know, kind of happen like that. At least to me, like the ones that have the most impact on me, they usually happen where it's just like, bop, there you go. Oh man, that was, and then all the pieces were already there. Here you go. And the whole thing's done, you know. Over Every Side, I think, is another one.
We're yeah.
In that place above the fish market. And I tuned my guitar into this, into a D minor for one. It was C sharp minor open tuning. And just sort of sitting on my mattress. And there's roaches and mice everywhere. And I just sort of finger picking this thing, and I was like, oh, that's cool. And then with, you know, as long as it takes to listen to the song, that's how long it took to write it, you know.
Wow.
It's just like, here you go. You know, it was all right there.
That song, it's very clever lyrically with how you wrote Blown Wide Open, you know, the messes all came to, it's like, you know, if you are listening, you can say, yeah, man, this is how fucking stuff happens.
You know? I think there's probably more articulate ways that I could have expressed what I was going for as far as the imagery of, you know, come out with your hands up, that kind of shit, you know.
Dude, that's it's perfect.
There's probably more clever ways that I could have, but maybe it wouldn't have had the same.
It's perfect. Yeah.
I don't know. I choose not to question that stuff. If it feels right, it feels right. Just leave it.
It feels beyond right.
I don't get any cringes from it, put it that way. There's plenty of moments where I get cringes, and I don't in that song.
That's your standard. If I don't get a cringe from it,
it's cringe free.
Overemphasizing, you just mentioned some amazing, like really haunting slide solo work on that, man. Mm. And one thing on Blow Mine Open, I had one more question or two questions. In the video, what guitar were you using? That's like a weird
flapjack. That's a Meridian flapjack.
Okay.
Our first guitar tech, John Meridian, Booth. His name's Booth. Lovely guy. I love him to bits. We designed he was like, you know, I'm a guitar builder too. I was like, no way. That'd be awesome. And then we just sort of designed like on a napkin in a hotel room. While we were on tour, I think we were probably on tour with opening for Creed or something like that. And then I don't remember. It might've been before that. And we just sort of like, I was like, well, no, I'm a taller guy. I was like, I want a bigger.
It's a massive guitar.
It's a big one. Yeah. It's bigger than those big Rickies, you know?
Yeah.
Like we took that as a sort of like, let's go from there and then make it. Yeah. I still use it to this day. Dave hates it when I pull it out because the bass kind of goes away. It's a huge sounding instrument.
It's massive.
It sounds as big as it looks.
That's cool.
I love it. It's hard to wrangle, but man, it's worth it. We use them in the studio. I have a bunch of flaps now.
That's awesome.
We use them in the studio along with the sewers. It's great.
And then on that same video, like, how did they do? Because like at one point you take this leap, like,
yeah, that's not me.
I figured it was like a stunt person or something.
Yeah, it's a stunt guy. Yeah, even he didn't have that much stuff on. He put on some like hockey equipment or something. He just really knew how to. But he jumped off of that. It was awesome to watch. It's
really awesome to watch, man.
This is back in the day when it took 2 or 3 days to film a video.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think. I wouldn't have done that. The part where my face bangs off the stair. Like, I remember that pretty vividly because that was me and it fucking hurt. I had a shiner the next day.
Oh, wow.
I had to do it like 4 times and I would hit my the side of my face off this corner of the stair.
Oh,
and the director is a big German dude named Ulf, wonderful guy and a great mind. But he was always like, he kept saying, it doesn't look realistic. Harder. You have to hit it harder. And I was like, man, it really hurts.
See, you're great with accents.
Got to the point where there was somebody, like one of the ADs or whatever, I was laying, the stairs went down like this, and I would lay like this, sort of half of my body going like that, and somebody would sit on my lower half and hold my shoulders up so that they could sort of slingshot me.
Oh, my God.
Into the stairs. And I was like, we did that 2 or 3 times, and then I was like, you know, and I remember after the first one, I was like, it hurts way too much. He's like, it needs to be hotter. And I just think, I remember him saying, someone get him some Jack Daniels. I was like, oh, okay, I'll try one more. And then, yeah, we did it 2 or 3 times, and the next day I had a shiner.
Oh, my God.
So that was me. I didn't do the big jump. Was awesome.
It needs to be hotter. You're great with accents, man.
Oh, no. Wolf was great. I love that guy. He was a fun guy to be around. He did the first video too, the Oaf.
Good stuff. And Albatross, a great song, great slide work. Again, it's just a really pretty song. Is there like a backstory to that? Is it a love song or?
I don't really get into, I don't like to get into too much where the sort of thrust.
Oh, totally cool.
Aside from what you can gather as far as being a listener or a reader, just because I'd rather not take that away from somebody else who has an attachment to it.
Yeah, and they may have a totally different interpretation. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I totally get it.
The words on the written page are going to be the words in the written page.
Right.
Sometimes the story behind them can add more fuel to that, whatever you're getting from the song. Sometimes it can take away from it, but I'm like, why roll the dice?
I totally get it and respect it.
Yeah, that. Just as far as the song, that thing had been around for a long time. I think I wrote that in Naples, actually. That's how
I
had that. Like I, on a 12-string acoustic, I just sort of like ring, 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 ring. And kept trying probably on the, I kept trying to fit it into different things and maybe it would be a midsection. Maybe it would be this, maybe it would be that. And I was like, well, what if it's the song? And it was Andy Curran that kept pushing for it. I'd made a demo of it, where it was really, really acoustic based and cause I was listening to like Gasoline Alley and a lot of that Rod Stewart, Maggie May.
Great stuff.
I was listening to a lot of that. And I was like, oh, I can take this riff and do that treatment with it where it's just, you know, I'll sing up higher and then have a real acoustic. And then that demo was pretty close to what the finished version is. But once Nick Raskulinix got a hold of it, he was like, no, we're going to do this intro. And then we do this. And like he had it all mapped out in his head, which I don't think he did prior to saying what he was saying. Like he just came up with this whole thing. And as he was saying, it was like, oh, I know what you're, okay. So we established a motif and then this is going to be like a Zep thing. You know,
it's a great song. Beautiful.
Thanks. And then it was the arrangement of it was quite a bit different. The demo, like the song itself was pretty much the same, but the arrangement was very different from how it ended up. I love how it ended up.
Oh, good, because it's great.
I was thinking like maybe do a synth part, and then it was just for the line, and then it was just like, nah, I'll just do slide. You know?
On your solo record, you have a song on there called All Along. I know you wrote that for your daughter. It's a sad song. I don't want to even talk about it, but I just want to thank you for writing that. It's a beautiful, I mean, it's a very beautiful, moving piece. Secrets, and you might not, now that I spoke, you may not want to talk about this. Is it, the secret lies with you. The secret dies with you. It reminds me of Blown Wide Open a little bit lyrically, like emotional stuff being put away. Anything you can share about the song without?
Yeah, that's much more sinister and darker as far as where it came from. You know, there's some specific things that are being referenced in my own sort of, I did sort of hide things and use terms that people aren't really familiar with, and they think I'm saying something else.
Right. Okay.
But it's actually very specific. Somebody that I'm talking to, and something that I'm saying that only they know.
You know what's funny? I got that out of this. Yeah. I thought that this was a message you were delivering to somebody.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, it doesn't take away from anything like great about what the actual lyrics are.
Essentially, I didn't forget that there's certain things that only you and I didn't fucking forget. kind of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It may be a little flowerier, you know.
Yeah.
Poetic license was taken, but right. That's, as far as I remember,
yeah.
that's where I was coming from.
What have been like the most important lessons you've learned or gotten from your whole experience with Big Wreck? Could be musically, business, life, entertainment, whatever you're comfortable sharing.
Business. I still haven't learned any. I'm glad in some ways that I haven't learned anything about the business because it helps the music. I know some people who, the business guides their music, and I think that's wrong, because the music is no longer an art form; it's a commodity at that point. And I said this in an interview like last week. I think in some ways I'm kind of lucky that I've never had a huge hit because I don't have to recreate that. I don't have to turn it into a business for other people.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It can always sort of be art for us. It can always come from a place of art, and as opposed to commerce. It's just not. But I think it's the most important thing I learned. I think is along those lines. It's just to sort of stick to your guns and you know, remembering why you love music in the first place, why you love playing music in the first place, and really staying in touch with that. And letting that guide the ship. Like I said, I've never been rich. I've never had a bunch of money. I don't know what that feels like.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I feel fucking great. But at the same time, I don't pray to that God. You know what I mean? I'm still innocent enough when it comes to that. You know, I'm still free to learn and explore every day, to try to get better every day. I don't have to, how do I recreate something?
Yeah. Yeah. How do I make sure? Well, the thing is praying to that God doesn't guarantee you get the money anyway.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's a big lesson for me.
Yeah.
Because there was a distinct conversation when I was about 29. It was like, well, if you do this and you do it this way, in 1 year's time, you, my friend, will be a millionaire. Like, really? What 29-year-old is going to say no? You're still
sure.
Playing rock shows. You're still playing rock music. it doesn't seem like you're selling your soul, right? So, you know, give it a whirl. It's like, wait a second. This doesn't feel this. It doesn't give me the same juice, you know? I need that juice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But having said that, like you said, it, you know, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to make that, get that, catch that brass ring.
Yeah.
And I, you know, who knows, maybe if I did, you know, become a millionaire and that year, maybe I'd be singing a different tune right now, like literally and figuratively, like just like, sure. Eh, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, got a place in the Bahamas. It is sweet. You know, like self-isolation. Fuck it. I got my own island.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
why
right.
not? Doesn't matter. I'm a huge yacht. Who knows? But I have a feeling that, you know, that it's the food for my spiritually and emotionally, yeah, and everything like that. Music and art and being inspired like that. You can't have that. You cannot have that.
It's not congruent at all.
Yeah, it's not for sale. I don't, and I know that from experience because being able to do what we do and make music the way we make music, you know, the thrill that you get from hearing something come from those two speakers that wasn't there before.
That was air. That's right, man.
Yeah, you know, and something that's coming from here.
Yeah.
And not thinking about this, just thinking about this, like that, the thrill that you get hearing that and not hearing dollar signs is you cannot put a price on that. It's better than anything.
It's interesting.
So I would have loved to have learned that even earlier, but I'm glad I learned it when I did. You know,
it's interesting you say that. I had a guy on the show. Obviously, I'm not going to say who it was, but we had our pre-call. We're trying to put it together. And I said, oh, how does this day work for you? And he goes, well, I'll be on my yacht that day. And I laughed just like that. And I said, well, does your yacht have internet? Like, I don't care. What's that?
Do you have Wi-Fi?
I don't fucking know. It's like, you know, like, what question were you answering? I mean, I'm asking you, are you available that, you know, yeah. It's just, but, and then his whole thing was, ironically, nobody really knows me.
Go.
And it was like, what a dichotomy, man. It was like, well, you know, whatever, man.
And it reminds me of like all this lofty stuff. We're talking about how important and precious art is and, you know, fuck money. It reminds me of it that you, money can't buy you happiness, but you can park your yacht next to it.
Yeah, man. No, but listen, man, you're making art. You can't, I don't see how somebody can make music and have it not come from the soul. Doesn't mean you can't make money with it, but it's got to come from the soul first, man. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
I've seen it. I've seen people who do it as a, you know, it's not, it's almost like it's a mathematical equation.
Yeah.
I've seen people do it and you know, it's fine for them. It's not for me.
Yeah.
My connection with it, and I hate to use this word, but it just, my connection with it is a bit deeper, you know, I think.
I think it's,
I feel something bigger. I feel something bigger than all of us when it's going right, you know. It's my version of whatever, but I do feel something when things are going right and things are happening, you know.
But so do I when I'm listening to it.
And along for the ride, and I don't try to figure it out. But I can definitely feel that there's something that you should not be putting a price tag on and you shouldn't be fucking with. You know,
yeah,
what I mean? Bigger than all of us. And it's like, we're plugging into something here. It's like, you have to be listening and, you know, not trying to force things into, well, it's got to be there so that we can make money for these people and us, you know,
right.
And like I said, it's also very lofty, but I'm not poor by any stretch, but I'm definitely shaking in my boots with all this COVID stuff because we are kind of hand to mouth.
Yeah.
You know, we need to play shows in order to feed kids.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to rethink a lot of things right now. And I know the guys are too, like we're in some, there's no blueprint for this for us.
No frame of reference at all.
Or for anybody.
For that matter. Yeah.
Not even musicians. Like there's a lot of people going through some really weird and hard times. But at the same time, if I sold out, as it were, and I had a big nest egg, I'd be pretty sweet right now. But you know, as it is, I got a guitar in my lap, a big giant vat of coffee next to me, and I'm going to try and write big worldwide smash hits.
And I hope you do it, man. And I'll listen.
No, I'm kidding. I'm going to write the most complicated, uncatchy song of all time. That's my goal.
Write something in write a jazz song. Hey, I have a question.
Jazz daredevil.
A listener sent in, Joe Guerrieri, and so condolences on loss of Brian, and he was curious if you've written any songs addressing that or your relationship with Brian, and also what was your favorite collaboration or part of a song that Brian contributed to from the Big Wreck catalog?
Thanks for the kind words. No, I haven't really addressed it lyrically. I've touched on it, you know. It's been almost a year, and I'm still sort of dealing with it.
Yeah, of course.
It's bite-sized pieces that I'm processing it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to force anything.
Yeah. You seem really good about that, man. I got to be honest with you.
I need to write an ode to my friend here. If something pops up, I have one of his guitars here that I pick up and strum, and I don't know if it's because it was his, but maybe it's just because it's a 12 string, or maybe it's because it's Brian's, but I play that thing. Something falls out of it every single time I pick it up, you know?
That's nice.
So that's truth. But no, I haven't specifically written a song for him. As far as my favorite of his contributions, there's been quite a few. Sometimes he'll take something that I'm working on, or I'll take a piece of music that I have, and I'll just sort of just put it on the edge like that. And what if you tried this? I'm like, oh, you know, and we sort of play that musical tennis. And it'll all happen very quickly. Like, how would you know that's a Brian riff off the first record that he played me over the phone? This is back when we had phones on the wall, you know. I had a guitar in my lap, and he had a guitar in his lap in New York. I think during summertime, like we were home from, because we were living together in
Natick?
In Roxbury.
Oh, okay.
In Boston. And I think it was either like March break or something like that. And he had a guitar, and I was starting to show him playing with open tunings and stuff. And he was dicking around with open G, and he's like, I got this thing. And he started playing, and I was like, ooh. And then, you know, within an hour, I had taken that riff and turned it into a tune. But that would happen like that all the time. Diamonds off of Ghosts. The main riff in that is one of Bry's. It was in like some weird time signature. I tried to massage that into something that was a little more toe tappy, but retained some of that sort of ethereal quality that it had. But he was, a deep well of knowledge and ideas, and, you know, just like the rest of us, he's always looking for that little trigger, that little spark of inspiration. There's countless things that, and certainly in the live situation where we bounce off each other and, you know, sort of, like I said, play musical tennis.
Very cool. Thank you, man. Appreciate you answering that. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What is your go-to guitar right now, and has that changed over the years? And what other two guitars would round out your top three?
My right now is this guy. This is the latest and greatest Sewer Ian Thornley SIG model.
Right on.
There's this one, and then the Roughneck, which is essentially the same, but it's got a rosewood board and uncovered pickups. And it's also got these sneaky little bad boys here.
Oh, put pots.
On these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and got my neck carve on it. I adore this. This one and the Roughneck are probably my favorites. I still have one of the Jazzmaster styled ones around, but a lot of my guitars are in storage and I can't get them.
Oh my God! That's right. So what kind of pickups are on there?
I got.
Are those sore pickups?
Oh, yeah, they're sore pickups.
Yeah.
What would round out the top three? Probably a Flapjack. I have one flap here.
Okay.
But it would be mostly sewer stuff and some Flapjacks. That's all. Like John has become a dear friend. I love him to bits. I've never met anybody like him.
That's so good.
With that kind of brain. And his son is very much the same as him. Their brains are so intimidatingly detailed. It's astounding. The shit that guy knows about guitars and amps, and you ask him one question, make sure you're sitting down because it's going to be a while. He'll go from just every aspect, every detail of whatever you ask them. And he knows. It's not like he's not riffing. He knows because he's done it. He's built one. Or he's reverse engineered one that didn't work properly from somebody else and figured out how to do it properly.
Right, right.
He's got some great quotes, John does. We get to I can't remember how he worded it, but it was something about somebody was bitching on one of the forums or something like that about not fucking sounding like this or sounding like that and using a sewer thing. And he's like, well, there's no trick for, you know, practice is the best thing for your tone.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
You can't just buy a great tone. You gotta work at it. And he had another one about vintage guitars and, you know, are they repeatable? And he's like, of course they are. It's not like there were magic trees back then.
That's good. They were magic.
He's great. He's great. And you know what? He does make a superior instrument. So, and so does Booth. You know, if you can get your hands on a Flapjack.
On a Flapjack. You got to be a massive man to get a Flapjack. I'm 5'9". Well, play a Flapjack.
He builds the short stack.
The short stack.
They're like 10 or 15% smaller, you know, for the average size man.
But then like as a, it's like demasculine, you know, it's demasculating asking for I need the short stack. I'm not big enough to play this.
You know, it looks goofy on me and I'm 6'4".
It's
know?
Massive, dude. It's
like shorter, normal size.
It's massive.
It's too much. But I you know, there's not a guitar that sounds like it. That's, you know, cool. If you need a lot of low end and low mids and something, you know, you grab jack. One of those Flapjacks.
Hey, do you have a favorite song that you wrote and a favorite song you like to play?
Not really. I don't. Like if they made it that far that they got recorded and put on an album, chances are I like them.
Right.
Because there's a lot of them that are, you know, laying on the side of the road along the way to make a record, right?
Oh, yeah. Especially you have a pretty good sized catalog at this point between everything you've done.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about that until recently. I was like, holy shit, that's a lot of music.
Ton of music, man.
And I've said this in interviews before, too. Like, I don't put a timeline on musical ideas. Because the good ones don't ever sound dated to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Great stuff from 100%. The 80s, you know, even though it has an 80s, like that really gated snare sound or whatever the synth sound is or whatever, the music itself doesn't sound dated. Do you know what I mean? It just sounds like, so I, when I'm putting a song together, putting a record together, there can be an idea that's however many years it is since I first started playing guitar that I've been trying to find a home for. It doesn't matter. If it hasn't become a song yet, then it's available.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And I have a stockpile of, you know, there's more every day. Some of them suck. Some of them are cool.
Well, you're really disciplined. I mean, before we started recording, you were telling me like your routine. You're very disciplined about getting shit done.
Yeah, I find that helps, especially, you know, with all this shit going on. I find that it helps. And within that, of course, there's a lot of wiggle room, you know, like if things just aren't happening and I cannot trick myself into being inspired, there's always more that I can do.
Right.
And I can practice. I can put a metronome on and just start working on stuff, you know, just doing the spring cleaning of technique and all that shit. So, you know, there's always work to be done. Oftentimes when I'm doing that, what we call quote unquote practicing, ideas will fall in your lap all the time. They'll never really happen if you go looking for them.
Yeah.
But you have to be, you know,
you have to have your antennas on, man.
You have to be in the same, you have to have your antennas on, you know. It's rare that, like, I'll be in the middle of something else and have an idea, you know. It has happened. You know, there's music in my head right now. Is it new music? Not necessarily. There's always melodies. There's always, and sometimes it's not even a musical thing. It'll be, I don't know, what's the word? Sort of a technical thing. Like, what if I went from that chord to that chord without using, you know,
using
this as a turnaround and things like that? Or what if I sang this note over that chord and then over this one, which would be weird, and then landed on that one but kept the same note? I'll have those kind of ideas.
That's so cool, man.
Try them and be like, okay, there's something there. Now, what do I have that has that movement? And there'll be a stockpile of, you know, let's try that. Does that work? And then, nah, it's not. But look at this. And then all of a sudden you're off on this. You know, and every once in a while, you just, you know, if you don't come at it with that perspective, which I rarely do, every once in a while, something will just fall in your lap. You know, I never say, that's not true. Sometimes I do say, I'm going to write something fucking heavy today. You know, and then it's just the sound that I'm working with is what triggers the, you know, what triggers the idea, you know. Okay, that's cool. Let's speed it up 10 BPM. How fast until it's going to break? Okay, let's back it off one, you know. But it, you know, how inspiring is that as a song? Meh. It's cool. It's fast. It's heavy. Is it Big Wreck? I have a few things that are just Big Wreck that are not going to be Big Wreck. And I'm like, I think we can do it, man. I think we can muscle it into a Big Wreck thing. And then Tyler, my partner, Tyler, was playing her some of the stuff is just like, she's like, that's not Big Wreck. Just like, it was too far out. It was too, you know. It was too little feet. Like, I was on a big little feet kick a few weeks back, and
everything started
coming out with this weird swung Cajun beat. You know?
That's like funny, man.
It's awesome. I love it, but it's not big rock.
It's so cool, man, to see your 30 years into this thing, your enthusiasm and excitement is like childlike almost. I don't mean
you have to maintain that.
But it's not, you know, but no, I don't think you have to maintain it. I think that has to come naturally. And if it doesn't, and you try to maintain it, that's where it's tough. But yours is very, you know, very, when I say childlike, very genuine, you know, it's so nice to see that. And like,
yeah, I still believe.
Yeah. It's fucking great, man. And then you're like, well, the difference is 30 years into this, you have all these arrows in your quiver, like, oh, let me put up the beat 10 beats per minute, you know, let me make something heavy today, oh, let me do this, you know, you have all these like opportunities that you've created for yourself over the years.
But at the end of the day, if it doesn't move you, it doesn't mean anything.
Right, you know? Right.
A cool riff is great, you know, a fast guitar solo is great. If it doesn't move you, it's not, you know, I'm not saying fast guitar solos don't move people. There's plenty that do.
Oh, of course.
But you know, fast for the sake of being fast. I mean, you know, the amount of time I spend working on technique and speed versus the amount of time I actually get to use it in a song is, what a waste of fucking time. It really is. It's not like I'm going to stop either, because it's like, I'm always on Instagram. Like, I gotta fucking get there. Okay. Turn the world off. Tick, 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 tick. And here I go, you know. You know, I should be working on other things. I know, but at the same time, it does give a certain part of my brain a bit of a break sometimes, just to focus on the metronome, you know.
And when you do
life in different ways and all that shit, it's a different part. It's like how some creative people will go get away from this and they'll do something else.
Yeah.
For me, my something else is guitar playing.
But when you do open it up, it's really amazing, man. It's
speed
like,
and that stuff.
Yeah, it's so.
Oh, no, there's plenty of people that are just way faster, and just look on the Instagram.
Listen, you just say Craig, thanks.
There's young guys too.
Doesn't no, just say Craig, thanks. That's
probably
it.
Not as tall as me though. So.
When you open it up, man, it's beautiful. That's the thing, man. I mean, and it's so. What's so amazing about it is it's so melodic. And I'm like, how does he find those notes so quick? I mean, it's like, it's very discernible, man, when you do that. Yeah.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Believe me, a million people.
Because like in my own head, I do. Well, when you're really hitting it, you're not really thinking. You're usually just somewhere else listening.
Right. You know, right.
You're really flowing. But if I were to hear it afterwards, if I hear something back, I'll be like, no, that's a Steve Morse lick. That's an Eric Johnson lick. Well, that's a Jimmy Page. I'll just start, you know, there's very, like some of the connective tissue to all of my influences. Like sure. If I had anything that sounded like me, it would probably be that, I guess. I think it's probably most guitarists are like that. Most musicians are, you are what you eat.
Yeah, 100%.
If something sounds like me, I guess it's the bits in between.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's like that.
The bits somewhere in between all of those, you know, all of those influences.
Hey, give me your top three just for this minute. Desert Island Discs.
Desert Island Records.
Yeah. And by the way, are those Roughnecks in the back, right behind you, to your left, right behind you on your left.
This way?
Is that your left? I think it's your left, right?
No, those are just parts casters. They're just beaters.
Oh, okay.
Things that I put pickups in and out of, and I'm constantly dicking around with the soldering iron.
They're really nice looking. I love the canary yellow.
Well, I like colors, you know.
Yeah.
I'm constantly looking for sounds that have already been created, you know.
That's great.
Under the guise of like, well, I'm going to. Nobody's ever done this. So I'm pretty sure John did that when he was nine. You know? there are many, many people that are far better at that than me and way more clever. I still burn myself all the time and burn everything around me with hot solder. I'll get a cheap guitar and, you know, start fucking with it.
That's good.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun, but it's still, you know, once you pick up something like this, it's like, oh, that's why. got it. Yeah.
Now you've got me very motivated to go play one of those, man.
Yeah, man. Do it. Fucking sewer. John is a genius. Three Desert Island Records. I don't know, man. What have we been listening to a lot of? I've been listening to a lot of Little Feet, a lot of Doobie Brothers, Christopher Cross. Come on, Sailing. It reminds me that the song that he did for the Arthur movie.
Oh yeah, that? Yeah.
Between the Moon in New York City.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, probably like six, seven, we used to so down at the end of our street where I grew up, there was a hockey rink, an outdoor
in Canada. Shocked.
Yeah, in
I'm
Toronto.
Shocked.
No. The thing is, I never played hockey, but as a kid, I skated in the winter.
Okay.
Because it was so close to our house.
All right.
But I could only ever turn in one direction because they'd let you go in one direction and go.
So you never developed.
I never really learned how to turn to my right. But
oh
I could
my god!
Rip to my left. But anyway, they had those. You know those those horrible old speakers that were like that. You know, there's usually two of them.
Speakers.
And they would play that. And my brother and I just ripping around in a circle. And I that song popped into my head and I had that memory. And then I just started doing some digging on Christopher Cross. And I was like, man, this guy's great.
He is great. Great songwriter.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I went on a big kick. Just some of it I have a hard time with, the whole Marrakesh Express thing. I'm like, you know, stop it. But there's some beautiful Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. You're not going to get better than that.
If you ever listen to, Stephen Stills' Manassas record?
I'm sure I have.
Yeah, that's pretty
sure
great
I have.
Stuff.
I went through a big kick of that like right before I went to college. What else? All the usual suspects are going to be there. You know, you're going to get the Floyd, Genesis. I went on a big Yes kick last week, where I basically listened to the entire catalog from the 70s.
Yeah,
and then capped it off with 90215 or whatever that one is.
Yeah, 90215. Well,
you know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of 90210. That was a TV show. But yeah, I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what the number is. Something like that.
Yeah.
That's the one, The Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Right.
I always kind of skip over that tune, though. There's a couple of great ones on there. It can happen.
It's a really good tune.
Big Generator is another record.
Yeah.
Like the Trevor Rabin era. I love some of that.
You mentioned Morse.
I
watched a bunch of interviews prepping for this. And you've mentioned Steve a bunch of times. Oh. I actually had him on here. I'm sure you've met him. He's such a lovely, lovely.
I've never really met him. I think I shook his hand once when I was in school. He was doing a clinic and I shook his hand. And later that night, he was doing a show at the Paradise in Boston. And I was front row, like right in front of him. He was probably like this fucking guy. So at the end at the end of the show. Like, here you go. I can leave.
No, he's not that. He's literally
watching every movie made. Yeah. And man, he's grimacing and just the way he played. I tried for a long, long time to get that sound. It's not just about speed. There's something that he's doing that. And I know he's a chronic practicer, like, you know, worse than me.
I'll send you his interview. I had him on. He's such a lovely guy. Oh my God.
I've heard good things. I've heard that he's a nice guy.
Oh my God. He's so nice. He's so mellow. He's such a hardworking.
It's great to hear when your heroes turn out to be nice guys.
Great work ethic. I mean, he lives here in Florida, like in the very rural part. Very nice. I mean, I'll send you his interview after.
Nice.
Very lovely guy, man. All right, tough questions here now, man. This is going to be very tough. What do you like most about yourself? Have a shot of Jack Daniels.
No,
he needs more Jack Daniels.
You know what I like most about myself right now?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying in general, like right now?
The
fact that I'm confident enough with myself to wear Crocs outside the house.
Right on, man.
I have a pair of tie-dye Crocs. I shit you not.
There you go. Yep. Ian Thornley, the simple
not
things.
Not too far from the house, mind you.
The simple things in life make them happy.
I still haven't gone to the store in Crocs, but you know, I will leave the house.
Baby steps, man.
Just on the sidewalk. They're like my next door neighbor yesterday was like, what's up with the Crocs?
I got some
for tea and I got some for my daughter. My son has little teeny Crocs. We all got Crocs.
Right.
That's what I like about myself right
no,
now.
No, man. You gotta answer that question.
I don't care. you want me to go deep? Do a deep dive?
Yeah, man. Oh, all this now he's looking at his watch that doesn't exist. Well, Craig, I've got 3 minutes left. What can I get?
I don't know. That's a tough one.
It is a tough one.
I don't know.
How about tell me this? What makes you happy, man?
What makes me happy?
Yeah.
Plenty. there's plenty that makes me happy. The sun makes me happy. Like I love a nice sunny day. You know, it can make or break me. That sucks sometimes. I can't remember the term, but I do get affected by, if it's gloomy, you know. I'd spent a lot of time in Vancouver a few years back. You know, I'm talking weeks on end, just in the studio, and then every day we'd come out and it would be gray and dreary, and I was depressed. About 2 or 3 weeks, it was the first time I'd experienced that, and everyone's like, "What's wrong, man?" And I was like, "I'm down." And then it was like, "Oh, I haven't seen." And then all of a sudden, it was sunny one day, and I was in the, and I was like, "There it is."
Yeah.
You know, I need that. I music makes me happy. People make me happy. I like, you know, I like everyone in this house. I love everyone in this house.
Well, that's good. Hey, not everybody could say that. Simple
things. Certainly nowadays, like everything that's going on now, T and I have gotten into a kind of a rhythm of, you know, being quick with a laugh and really enjoying the little things, like a sunny day.
Yeah.
You know, Bo took his first steps last week, and that was huge.
Oh, congratulations, man. Right on.
So every, you know, and that's not a little thing, but like that made me, that carried me for, you know, it's, I'm still on that high.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he is too. Like he's pretty proud of himself, and it's an awesome thing. But,
well, you enjoy it. You got like 12 years till it falls apart, man.
Yeah. Believe me. No. I don't know. I'm a lucky guy. I really am a very lucky guy. I get to do what I love for a living and, you know, and have lovely people around me. Yeah. So
who's had the biggest influence on you musically and then personally?
I couldn't really count one. I have a lot. I mean, like I said earlier, I got a lot of influences, a lot of heroes. And they're all of equal importance to me. I couldn't pick one. And so, you know, sometimes I write with that in mind as a, almost a sort of homage or a tip of the hat. I'll be like, this is going to be the most Mark Knopfler sounding thing. Like it's going to sound more Knopfler than Knopfler.
Right.
You know, that watch this. And it just, and I'm not talking about the writing of the song. I'm talking about the treatment of it, how mm-hmm. it sounds, you know, or Jimmy Page or Hendrix or whoever it is that you're trying to, sometimes it's a fun place to start. And then of course all the wankers on the internet will say like, "Oh, it sounds like," I'm like, of course it does. That's what it's supposed to.
Man, I don't understand anybody criticizing. I just don't get that.
Oh, thing. It's the comments on YouTube. I used to fear them. And now I love them. I just think it's hilarious.
Who has the time? Who
exactly?
Who has the time?
I don't know anyone who actually comments on YouTube.
I mean,
so let's talk about that first. Like, who are these fucking people?
Why?
They are funny, though. They are funny.
They are funny, but like
so mean. They are so mean.
Yeah.
I thought that guy said, "I hate the way Ian inhales." you just can't find that anymore.
No, man, that's priceless. Oh my great god.
I can breathe now.
Yeah, right. I had one and the guy said, "This interviewer is a dope. He knows nothing about country music. I can't believe he didn't ask, I don't remember who the guest was, this important thing in his career." And I never did this before. I've never responded to anything negative. But I said, you know, my wife is a very, is an angel, man. And she's always like, "Craig, you want to kill people with kindness." And, you know, and I'm from the Bronx. I just want to kill people. So I said, right?
No kindness.
Yeah. Right. So I said, yeah. Okay, let me just, I'm older, I'm more mature. Let me do this. So I waited a couple of days and I responded to the guy's message and said, "Hey man, you are 100% right. I know nothing about country music and I have so many, my guests, I have a lot of guests on the show and they're from so many different genres. It's just not possible for me to keep up. I appreciate you listening anyway and thanks." Do you know, I was amazed. A day later, he said, "I am so sorry."
Yeah.
I was fucking shocked. Because I didn't write it with that in mind. I just like it was like an experiment to respond because I'd never.
If it came back like teeth out, then you're the dick.
I would never waste energy on that.
Actually, respond to the guy and you're super nice. Then it's just like, yeah, I guess I'm kind of a dick. If it's just hanging out there, then it's just hanging out there. That's fine too. But if you respond with something that's really nice and just sort of thoughtful, and it's just like, oh, I'm such an asshole.
But that's what he did. He was like, I'm so sorry. You're right. Blah, blah, blah. And I didn't do it for that reason. I just like was an experiment. I would never waste energy fighting with somebody.
Yeah.
Even in person, I don't waste energy. So I'm certainly not going to fucking do it on the internet, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it'll get my blood up sometimes. Like some of the things that I'll read that are just wildly inappropriate and wrong.
I hate the way Ian inhales.
I can't stand them. I can't stand the know-it-alls. And it's like, that's it. Well, Ian was obviously, and it's just like, don't talk about us like you know something when you really don't. And it's like, sometimes I'll read things that I can tell, like, I'm like, that guy just made that up, because there's nowhere on the internet or elsewhere where that exists other than him saying it.
Oh, I know. Sometimes you feel bad for these people because they're in dire need.
I feel bad for the people that are reading it.
They need attention. They need attention.
And here's the other part is like, I have a 16-year-old daughter. If she wants, which I'm sure the last thing she'd want to do is read anything about Big Wreck or me. But, what if she could stumble on some of this stuff?
They're like, not
horrible things being said about, us and me.
Yeah.
That concerns me a little bit, but she's got a great head on her shoulders and she knows better,
Yeah.
She knows that there's a lot of weirdos out there. And it is kind of enraging when you see people just making shit up, numbers, making up facts, just make it up, send it out there. Nobody will check it. Doesn't matter. It's like, wait a second. That's me you're talking about. And that's not true. Even though I won't say anything, I'll never comment. Tyler would kill me if I ever commented. That's what they want, Ian.
Yeah, that's what they want. That's what they want. I've never responded. I've responded once to that guy. I've never responded. That's it. Ever.
So like Dave McMillan has great rules about all that stuff, and I should start following that. He never reads the comments. Just stay away. If you do a post, you just fucking post it and forget about it. Just turn the other way. Like as soon as you put something out there, you put it out, bounce.
That's like, it's healthier.
You're like, I wonder what people would say. And you go back and,
I think that's the best quote I've heard in 700 shows. I hate the way Ian inhales.
Isn't it awesome?
That is fucking amazing.
I can't get pissed off at that.
No, that's fun. I mean, like,
that's awesome.
I've never actually thought about how someone's inhaling actually.
What's wrong with how I inhale? There's a part of me that's going to go like.
Hey, how did my inhaling?
I don't know what they mean.
You're going to be like, hey, how did my inhaling go during this interview?
When we're done, will you shoot me straight?
Be honest,
dude. How's my inhaling?
Honestly, you're probably one of the best inhalers that I fucking had on the show, dude. I'm telling you. That's really great, though. That's classic. That's the best one I've ever heard. I hate the way Ian inhales. Wow, man. Yeah. I hope I'm dead before I have that much bandwidth left over that's what I'm paying attention to. Wow. Tell me, do you have any hobbies, man, outside of music?
Not really. I mean, I get asked that a lot. I like to cook. I really do.
Number one hobby of musicians.
Yeah, like. Just a different aspect of music would be my hobby. I try to golf. I've tried that. I'm terrible, but it is fun to get a hold of one.
Yeah.
I've never kept score. Not really. Anyway, it's not, I don't take it that seriously. So I haven't gone in well over a year. What else? Brian was an avid fisherman.
Oh yeah, what kind
and
of?
That's something that something about that appeals to me. Just the image in my head of just quiet time alone, being focused on.
It's very relaxing.
Getting outside yourself and just sort of I love all that. Cycling is a great one for me. Doing that, even though now we have one of those. you know, inside bikes that we use when the weather's shitty. But no, Sophia and I went for a nice bike ride yesterday. That's cycling is great for me, and that and has been since I was a kid. After my mom died, my dad took my brother and I cycling from. So we flew to San Francisco with our bikes, and then we cycled north into Napa Valley, and then turned around and came down to PCH on our bikes. We used to cycle a lot more than I do.
Dude, that must be amazing memories from that. That's a great.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we needed it. I think the three of us were all sort of reeling, and you know, we weren't. Maybe in a way, we were kind of running from something in one aspect, but in another, I think it was a good. Let's get out of here for a bit and.
How old were you when your mom passed?
15.
14, yeah, that's 14, young.
15?
Sorry, man.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, that was another one. It was tough. But yeah, you know, it's something that it's a great escape, you know, just both literally and figuratively. It's great. I only got my proper driver's license last year.
Really?
I've always lived in a city, so it's always been like a walk or a cab, or when I was a kid, it was always the TTC or the bus and the T in Boston. It was always that.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And I never, you know, I'd have my learners or whatever, the first level. I've had that several times and just never gotten around. I knew how to drive, never gotten around to having a license. But then I think when Tyler got pregnant, I was like, okay, I got to do this. I got to get my license. And Sophia's been driving now.
I was going to say, your daughter probably had her license before you. Yeah.
She's great. And she's got her learners, the G1 or whatever they call it. She's got that. We take her down. There's a parking lot near here. We can take her. And, but yeah, it's always been, cycling has always been a great one for me.
That's cool. Hey, two more questions, and I can't thank you enough, man. You're a very sincere person, man, so thank you. I really appreciate that.
That's lockdown. I'm happy to talk to anyone about it.
What does that mean? Is it like a backhand? Craig, even you. And I don't even like the way you fucking inhale.
When we stop taping, I'm going to talk to you about your inhaling. Driving up the wall.
Yeah, driving me nuts. I'll work on that. They're tough questions, man, just to prep you. Toughest decision you had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
I don't know, man. That one would take a while. Decision? I don't know.
Toughest decision you had to make or most difficult thing you had to do?
Well, how personal do you want to get? Like, there's been some doozies that I probably wouldn't.
Totally up to you, man.
Let out there into the people who want to comment about it. I don't want
to. Not only does he inhale badly, but listen to this. share something, whatever you're comfortable sharing.
Well, I think when making decisions based, making ill-informed decisions based on the wrong things, and I've done that, you know, when I was younger, and I made some decisions but steering things in a different direction, which you know, left some good people behind, and that you know, that still eats at me. And I'm just talking in the business side of things, you know. I mean, people that were really close. And then we wanted to take things in a different direction. And then, it was like sort of managers and agents that, you know, and good people that were working with us. That sort of, and that sucks. You know, that sucks. And it's something that I think about a lot. Not really as a regret, but like I wish that I would have handled that differently.
Yeah.
You know? On a personal level, because business is going to be business and it's going to carry on as business does. How you handle it and how you deal with it and how you interact with people is something that is within your control. And I don't think I handled it, you know, I was young and stupid, but I don't think I handled it as well as I could have.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because I had a note here, and I relate to this actually really well, because, you've done a couple of interviews and where you mentioned the as you've gotten older, your coping skills and your communication has gotten better, and you've had some regrets. And I relate to that because I've had many of my own. And I think about those things too sometimes, like, you know, the collateral damage because of my own bad decision-making or my own bad communication or inability to process or understand how to handle that. And it does weigh heavy at times.
I think, like, you know, if you watch that, if you watched any of that Michael Jordan and the Bulls, that
I've watched the first almost the first three. Yeah,
I think there's, like, when you see, I mean, I all of us grew up huge Michael Jordan fans.
Yeah,
you know? And I was a big basketball player. I was one of my obsessions when I was young. But to see the sort of see behind the curtain a little bit, and that kind of drive and that kind of singular focus at any cost. Like, if you're going to hurt people's feelings, you're going to steamroll them. It doesn't matter. There's one fucking goal and we're getting there. I think sometimes that kind of drive and that kind of focus can have, there are casualties involved. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the most successful people in the world or even people like me. I think the drive and the focus is the same, but I'm a hell of a lot more aware of if there are going to be any, and I'm not comparing myself to Michael Jordan in the least. Don't get me wrong. I kind of related to the, I was like, okay, that might be, that's something that a little bell went off in my head when I was just like, that was kind of a dick move. And that's Michael fucking Jordan. I can't say that about Michael Jordan. But wait a second, that was, you know, and that's something that I'm sure he is, you know, as someone who's, or maybe not.
Like, maybe
he's
not.
He's such a, like, there's this thing that has to be within you that I think, you know, and that's something that I don't have. That's sort of that competitive.
You got to be a killer, killer instinct.
And when I was young, I had some of that. Yeah. There was some piss and vinegar that was connected to some of that. Like, I got this guy. You know, that kind of thing. I don't have that anymore. I could care less.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's a fruitless, it's a waste of time and it's a waste of energy. And in realizing that, if that kind of thing can have consequences, no thanks, man.
Yeah.
Because you didn't get a prize for, you know, being better than that guy.
Man.
Not in this game.
Right.
You know,
not in any game.
Fucking do. Well, you do.
Well, if you're in competitive sports, sure. But like in.
That's a younger man's game and it's a younger man's philosophy. And once you've exercised that muscle so much, I don't know if you get rid of it. I don't know how that works because I've never been a professional athlete or never, you know, it's a different thing. I know plenty and they're lovely guys and gals. But I'm sure, you know, if you were a fly on the wall in the sort of in the dressing room, you know, something in the heat of battle and playoff games, it's got to be a different kind of energy than what normal day-to-day people are used to.
Well, you're putting out, you're coming from a different place. What you're doing is, in the goal of it is to envelop and warm as many people as possible.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, it's totally opposite. Their goal is to fucking destroy the other team. It's not really apples and apples.
I haven't really given it enough thought to try and figure out what I was, why that sort of resonated with me. Or maybe it could have just been because I was always such a fan and always just in awe of how amazing he was. And then to know that it's like, but at what cost, you know?
Yeah.
So what, I don't have, you know, a lot of great friends around, or, you know, I don't have this deeper connection with my, it's like, does that really what it takes? And you know, I don't know. I think what I do, it's the focus, like I said, the focus I don't think is any different. And the amount of drive and the amount of time and the amount of passion and the, you know,
oh, it's very similar to being a professional athlete as far as all of those things.
The
practice, the training, the rejection, the continued, you know, up early, isolation, all those things mirror profession.
There's a cocksure sort of confidence that I guess gets built up, you know, once you had your ass kicked more than a few times, and you just sort of start hardening a little bit. And I know, you know, people can look at that as somebody being cocky or being an asshole, but I think, you know, that sort of comes with the territory. It's the exact opposite of how you want to be when you're in a situation like this, where you just want to write and you want to be as vulnerable, and, you know, you want to open a vein and just be as truthful and vulnerable as possible. But when you're out there and you're traveling around in a busted minivan, playing for $50
to four people,
half a case of beer, and you don't even have enough money to eat after the show because you got to put gas in the shitty minivan to get to the next show. And you do that for a couple of years, and you know, when you do finally get a good guitar amp and you're able to turn it up real loud, you're going to play the shit out of that thing.
Yeah.
No matter who's there, you know, especially if there's other guitar players there. I'm here to do this.
Yeah, also, absolutely.
And you know, should. There's a part of that. And I don't think that's competition. I think it's just, and I don't think it's particularly cocky either.
No, it's like, this is what I do, man. I've honed my skills and I've beaten myself up and I've gotten beaten up, and here's the finished product.
And I survived.
Yeah. And I survived, and you can't even inhale properly. Yeah. I mean,
I don't have a choice. That's my problem. Yeah. I never had a fucking plan B.
Hey, one more question, man. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years.
And probably just what we were talking about. I'm a lot more easygoing. A lot less guarded. I'm not as pissed off. I was pissed off a lot, you know.
Yeah.
I was pissed off for a lot of different reasons. And reasons that just don't get under my skin anymore.
Did you make a conscious effort to... Like, I was the same way. I made a conscious effort to fix that, though, because
I had to go to therapy and everything. Like, yeah. There was a lot of shit. There's a lot of stuff, you know, constant maintenance.
It's life, man. It's like, if you live more than 40 years, like, and you don't have any scars, you're lying or something. You haven't left the house.
You're gonna be fucked up somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, totally, man. No, but
I think, yes and no. There's sort of a self-awareness maybe that it's sort of something, putting a mirror in front of your face and being like, oh my God, I actually said that, you know?
Once you let this shit go, didn't you feel like a million pound weight lifted off your shoulders though? Then I fucking sure.
Yeah, I think so. But it was a gradual process, I think.
Hmm.
I've never been one to... It always takes me, with most things in life, aside from sort of athletic-based things or music-based things or art-based things, those always came really quick.
Right.
I could figure them out, and I could sort of see how it feels to make that motion, and okay, I got it. And with music, with the ears, I could always just figure something out, and okay, I got it. With a lot of other things in life, like, you know, how to be, it takes a fucking while for me to really, you know, to make the change, to turn that corner.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight for me. And, you know, there's not every day I wake up and I'm going to do this, I'm going to fix this. It's a gradual thing for me. I always take some time. And eventually you just sort of, oh yeah, that was, you know, I was really angry. I was a pissed off kid, you know, pissed off for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And then I was a pissed off adult.
That's what happens. That doesn't wear off. It actually probably gets worse.
Yeah. I think Brian and I both, when we got back together and with this thing and started calling it Big Wreck again, we both came at it like, you know, Brian is much like me. He could be pissed off. And eventually just let it go. You know, what's the point?
Yeah, man, there's none.
It's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. And And you know what? We sort of figured out a great rhythm, because we used to get into some rows back in the days, you know, like two pissed off guys. And Forrest and Dave were usually a little more affable. But Brian and I were just sort of, you know, the sort of fiery ones, and just sort of up and down. And you take whatever it was we were doing back then, to throw a bunch of booze on it, and then, you know, there's going to be some fighting.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's, we were young and stupid. You know, we would get into it, and nothing even came close, you know. The second time around, like for the last four albums in the touring cycles they're in, there hasn't been, you know, there'll be a few brief arguments, or like, you know, if somebody's in a shitty mood and sort of says something, but it'll get cleaned up. It doesn't sit and fester. It'll get cleaned up and dealt with. I know those are things you learn, and those are actual tangible devices that you can use. Like, don't leave something out there, because, you know, it'll turn into something later.
Yeah.
Fucking clean it up and move on, you know. Whole hug it out thing. It's like, that's great, but there are some words that need to be said.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that, you know, we were both.
But once you get older, you realize it's okay to say those words. It doesn't mean you're going to turn into, you know, someone's going to shoot you, or you're going to like give up all your superpowers. You know, that's the cool thing about it.
Yeah. You're not going to be the bitch.
Yeah. Right.
That's the Boston way to say it.
The biatch. Yeah, man.
The bitch.
Hey.
No, I totally agree. It is a maturity thing. It doesn't have anything to do with age. It has to do with maturity.
Yeah. Awareness. Yeah.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time getting good at one thing and not so great at others.
Yeah, which is normal.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, man. Thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much, honestly, man, for all the fucking amazing music you've made, man. And I know it's like probably easier to bang a nail into wood than to get a compliment to sink into you. But I mean it. You have made me feel so good so many times over the years. And I know when I put the word out that you were coming on the show, like, it all lit up. Everybody was so happy. So you've made a lot of people feel that way, man. Oh, fuck, man. Yeah. What you do is really special, and how you do it is really special. And I hope you keep making music for a long time, and I hope you come down to Tampa here, man.
Great.
Let me tell people where to find you and maybe what's going on. So check out, follow Ian Thornley and Big Wreck on Instagram, on Facebook and Twitter. And also keep your fingers crossed when COVID-9, whenever we come back to fucking life somehow, Ian will be touring. Big Wreck will be touring. We don't, you know, they don't know the dates. They had an extensive tour in Canada plan. I'm assuming that would be picked up at some point in time. And maybe a new record potentially coming out.
Yep.
Awesome.
It's all the dates are the things that are sort of liquid right now. Nothing's been set in stone, because nothing's been set in stone. So, there will be a record. There will be tours. There will be shows. It's all going to happen. I just don't know when.
And if you're an inhaling coach, please email Ian to help him improve his inhaling. Cause it's,
that's what I was going to do, is like take this time downtime to really work on my breathing, you know, not just my breathing, just we're going in. I'm having some hard times.
Yeah. If anybody has any inhaling advice, we can't have Ian Thornley fucking running all over YouTube with this ridiculous inhaling technique.
Who says that? Come on.
I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't even say that number. There's not enough boot credit limit on my card to even drink the amount I need to fucking have that come out of my brain. Anything else you want to promote or talk about before we go?
Sur guitars, man.
Get the
amps and pedals.
Ian Thornley Roughneck.
Do yourself a favor. I've been playing guitars a long time, and I have a lot of them. I play a lot of guitars. I have played many. And, you know, I sound like I'm doing a commercial.
That's okay. It's your guitar.
For real, honestly, it's the best one that's being made. And I know that from experience. I've played once you play that and then you go back and you play the other ones, it's just, you start seeing the flaws. Even someone like me, and I'm just not that detail oriented, you know, action this and blah, 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 that. I'm just kind of a field player. And it's just like, these are just, when you play an instrument that's made properly and somebody's thought it through and they're not just doing what was done before, they're, it's a great company and they're great people. And these ones even have my name on the back.
You're a big guy. Is it a real thick neck? You're a big guy. Is that a real thick neck?
Not particularly thick neck.
Okay.
I don't know. I can't remember what the measurements are, but it's thicker than most, but not by a lot. I have some guitars that have the huge, they call it the huge neck, and it's actually an inch, like from there to there, like the middle.
That's huge.
But the problem with that is if the shoulders, which is the parts that are on the side, if the shoulders come down a bit too much, I don't find that comfortable. So when they're shaved in a bit, like a V shape, because I can play with my thumb over the top, mm-hmm. and I play with my thumb behind, and you know, just the way that these things are made, it doesn't feel big. It has a good, it's great to grip, but you can also, you know, you can hustle on it if you need to, and you can grab a hold of something and, you know, give it what for if you need to. It's just the perfect.
Give it what shape. For? That's very, yeah, very Canadian.
It took a while to get. There was a lot of back and forth, but yeah, having that V here that goes all the way up, oh, it's just such a pleasure to just put it in your lap and play it.
What do those run cost wise? The Ian Thornley models.
Well,
ballpark,
but they're not as expensive as like some other ones that you would, that like comparable guitars, they're not as expensive. That's what John keeps saying. He's like, I never wanted to be the biggest. I just want to be the best. But in my opinion, it already is. Like, they already are, not discounting any of the other guitar makers. I don't know some of them. I've never played some of them, but some of the big ones I have, and it's apples and oranges, man. They're just not made as well.
Right on, man.
But yeah, you'd have to look it up.
Well, it's well deserved, man. You deserve it.
It's not $20.
What's that?
It's not $20.
It's not $20.
You're not cheap.
But it's well deserved. I'm glad you got your own signature model. Well deserved.
Yeah, dude. I keep saying it to John. He's like, yeah, fucking then we're going to sell a couple of these things. I'm like, I don't care as long as I get one.
It's all about me. As long as I get
it. Really is. It's my favorite guitar. It's got my.
That's the
name
Michael
in the
Jordan in you. Look at that. Hey, let me say goodbye to everybody. Thank you, man. Hold on and we'll wrap up. But thank you very much for everything, man. I really appreciate your time. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Ian Thornley. If you are not familiar with Ian's music, I implore you, I urge you to go listen right now while this is fresh in your mind and before anything else comes up. Go put on In Loving Memory, put on his solo record, Ian Fletcher Thornley. Just listen to anything. He's amazing. And most important, especially nowadays, man, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely, as is inhaling. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Ian, thank you so much, brother.
Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.